I'll have a blue Christmas.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is a Friday afternoon, and, well, you know, the reason we're blue, the reason we're down a little bit is because Andrea Haines, who usually joins us from Blue Sky Innovation, the editor, she's not in the studio today. She's out looking for a snap bot. Andrea, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. And I love the Blue Sky theme music you've got going on there.
Very nice. You got it. I didn't get it. Tom Rush is producing, and I gave him a look, and he was like, clearly I missed it. So I'm glad you picked up on that. Are you all ready for the holidays?
I'm this close, super close. A little bit more to do.
I'm good enough. And we have great friends, the Hagemans, who have an Eve of the Eve party every year. And so that's what everyone's looking forward to. The kids are home and everyone gets together. So I can't wait for that tonight. I am sitting just over my left shoulder is the big star for the Chi-Town Rising. We'll talk to the organizers from that a little later on the show, too, as they try to keep that going and build on some momentum from last year. But I want to talk to you about, I was kidding about a snap bot, but Snapchat, we've talked about their spectacles that they've come out with. And they're selling them now, what, in vending machines around the country?
They do. They have kind of a pop-up vending machine, and they give very little notice as to where those are going to show up. And they've shown up around the country in kind of unusual places in some cases. And finally, one came to the Chicago area this week to an Orland Park Dave and Buster's.
And why Dave and Buster's? Are they partners?
You know, it's an arcade setting. Like one of these, you know, it popped up in there and people lined up to get them.
And they're like, they're Snapchat. It's like Snapchat that you can wear, right? You can print your own stories, print your stories from your glasses.
Exactly. It kind of, to me, reminds me of, you know, like kind of Google Glass meets GoPro kind of thing. Like you wear it on your face. It is very noticeable. So I think for people that worry about like people secretly taping everyone or something like that, these are brightly colored. A light goes on when you're filming. So they're like, you know, they're more of almost like a novelty or a toy type of feeling about them.
You know, speaking.
And they allow you to.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, they allow you to take like super quick videos that you can then easily post right into Snapchat.
Speaking, though, of recording people and not knowing, I guess people do know, but one of the things that you had in Blue Sky this week was an interview with Harper Reed, who ran, what, the technology for the Obama campaign in 2008, right?
Yeah, so he was the chief technology officer in 2012 campaign for Barack Obama, and he's definitely one of Chicago's best known kind of just pure technologists, tech guys.
And he gave a TED Talk right after 2012 that was just released, right, where he kind of predicted that campaigns would be hacked the way the Russians apparently hacked the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, his comments then definitely sort of foretold a little bit what happened. And he's just kind of an interesting guy to have chew on this because he talks about how, you know, to some degree it's going to be expected for businesses, for governments. Here's some of the things that they need to do to stop it. But the interesting point he makes is no matter how high tech and, you know, things that you think a campaign should be, there's tons of people involved in campaigns. And where you have people, you always have entry points where things can happen.
I thought it was interesting, too, that he said in 2008, both campaigns were hacked. It would have been McCain's and Obama's. But it was a different time. You would hack to try to get information to beat the other guy. It was sort of pre-WikiLeaks. So that information wasn't being released the way WikiLeaks did in 2016.
Exactly. Yeah, this time it certainly went so much wider and it influenced, you know, voters' opinions and things like that in a way that wasn't happening so much before.
And it was emails. I want to ask you, and this is a little off track, but, you know, Rahm Emanuel is in the news from a Tribune lawsuit, in part, having some of his personal emails released because they were used for government business or might have been used for government business. And we talked a little bit about this on our podcast, The Mincing Rascals, with Kristen McCreary and Eric Zorn, John Williams, that's out at WGNplus.com. But I'm interested in this idea that emails now are subpoenaable, if you will, because there's a record. So you and I could have a conversation in a hallway, and no one could subpoena that because there's not a record. We might have the same exchange on email, but simply because there's an electronic record now, I would have to turn it over. I wouldn't have to turn over a phone conversation, right? It's just email sort of stands. I wouldn't have to turn over my mail. Email stands alone just because there's an electronic record.
That's true. Yeah, email is definitely, you know, I would say, as we've all been saying, and of course no one listens, but don't put things in an email that you don't want to have right back to you in court one day, right? That's the rule of thumb. I would, you know, there is, of course, a distinction between someone who's working for the public, like our mayor.
Sure.
There's definitely, you know, there's a slightly different standard there as well. I mean, the public is entitled to the, you know, records about government business, of course.
Yeah,
but
I know.
Hacking, I mean, that can happen to anybody. Like now, whether or not, whether it's legal, illegal, public, private, business, whatever, I think everybody needs to be thinking about it.
Yeah, and he talked about having dual access, right? A fingerprint or voice activity or something, not just one password to get into your computer system.
Definitely.
All right, so yeah. Let's go to San Francisco. Why are Uber cars running red lights there?
So Uber cars are now screeching out of California and into Arizona. they have been, you know, Uber loves to push the envelope. That's what they're all about. They love to drive regulators crazy.
And we're talking about self-driving cars.
Exactly. They've started using, you know, these sort of autonomous vehicles, although they're not really autonomous because they still need a live person in the car to kind of make sure nothing's going wrong and really be still, you know, somewhat actively involved. So they're not completely autonomous at this point. But they got booted out of California and basically turned around and went straight to Arizona. So they plan to continue testing there.
The problem is they got booted out of California because they weren't getting the licenses. That's not quite the right word. Permits maybe that the state thought they should get. Uber thought they were exempt. So Uber just picked up their driverless cars and moved a little bit east.
Exactly.
All right. Yes. Andrea Haines, thank you very much for joining us. And look, I've had a great time talking to you all year round. And I appreciate your flexibility and all this, and I can't wait for next year.
Yeah, me too. Same to you. Happy holidays to you and your family and everyone in the studio.
All right, same to you, Andrea. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Let's check the traffic hotspots. Here's Jill Egan. Well, 22, it is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for being there. Tom Gimbel is the CEO of the LaSalle Network and is with us most Fridays. Thank you for being there, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to be with you. Happy holidays.
Same to you. 2016, pretty good year on the job front.
It was a great year. And yeah, I mean, the stock market's up. People are hiring.
I know that you did a survey looking ahead, too, and that's what I'd like even more because it looks like we're all going to get raises and everyone's going to be hired.
Yeah, everybody will be happy all the time.
Let's go home.
Well, I think one of the big breaks, though, between that there are jobs to be had is that there's also a skills gap.
Right.
So there's a lot of technology, a lot of higher-level marketing, data analytics, sales jobs, and the population just isn't there.
And so in the survey, I think the number, it was a high number, like
83%. A little over 83% of respondents said it's difficult to fill the openings they have with qualified workers.
So there are jobs out there, but there are people looking for jobs, but they don't match the qualifications
Correct.
Of the open jobs.
Yeah, so if you have people that are undereducated,
right.
And you've got jobs for analytics, quantitative analytics, and people that are doing that, it doesn't match up.
I'm educated in my eyes.
And you can't do quantitative analytics.
I don't even know what that means. Okay, so let's go then to coal country, right? Because this is what got Hillary Clinton in trouble,
yep.
Where she said, coal isn't coming back. We need to find ways for you guys who work in the mines to become qualified for these open jobs. Is that possible? Can you have someone can you catch up that quickly?
I think what people are hoping and why the election, one of the reasons it went the way it was is because I think coal's going to come back. I think natural gas and getting the pipeline done. We were talking off air. But contrary to any political affiliation, if we have a little bit of deregulation across the board, and if there is the natural gas, if there is coal coming back, if there are some of those things, some groups of people will be unhappy, but there'll be a lot of people that throw hammers, quote unquote, for a living.
Right.
That are going to have more access to jobs.
Okay. So the stagecoach just got a reprieve.
Yeah.
The stagecoach isn't our future.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if it's not this year, next year, it's five
Eventually.
Years, right?
Right.
How do you take someone who worked in a mine or a factory, and I'm not questioning anyone's intelligence, I'm just talking about an education level, or I couldn't do it. Are these sorts of jobs that an adult can make the leap when it comes to training?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of the Albert Einstein quote, if you judge a fish by its ability to do whatever, then think it's stupid for, you know, butchering it. But
no.
I think that
makes perfect sense.
Thank you, I appreciate that. People
in the spirit of the holidays.
Yeah, right. People have abilities that we don't know they always have. Right. There's
right,
a big
right,
push
right.
on the Asperger autistic range right now that those people are great at analytics jobs.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, yeah,
that their brains, they might not be able to engage in conversation as well as other folks, but their ability to analyze data is off the charts.
Right.
There's an article in The Economist about it about 6 months ago. On the flip side, I think there's people that are working in factories, that are working in plants, that do have aptitude for other things. What I've been saying is the new deal for this century will be education. We've got, if the government has to figure out if it's going to do a social service across this country of how to educate people, and then it's up to the people to take advantage of the education. Because even if we go all fully machine, someone's got to build them. Someone's got to fix them.
I'm just thinking, you know, I've been in radio, and if you told me in radio goes away that I had to find a job in data analytics, you know, it would scare the hell out of me.
No, but you'd go into sales or you'd go into something else,
right?
There's other tendencies.
Okay, so the jobs are there. There'll be more people hiring, and the people who have jobs are going to be getting raises?
Well, 87% of leaders said that they make promotions based on merit, not tenure. So what we're really getting to is more of a meritocracy. And so people who are there and that do work and that are working all these, there isn't as much quote-unquote work-life balance as people talk about on the internet, they're going to get raises. Companies know they have to hold on to their talent.
Okay, and the other thing that strikes me, and these are two points. One is that when the hirers do their search, they're looking for people who are going to fit into the culture of their workplace.
Yep.
When they ask the workers what keeps them going back to work, it's their coworkers.
Yep.
So that's sort of two sides of the same coin, isn't it? It's all about the culture.
Yeah. You know, so often people say, oh, I mean, and it's important to have a diverse workforce. But it's important not because necessarily the diversity needs to exist. It means that we shouldn't discriminate based on diversity.
Sure.
Right? But people want to work with people who have the same views. They don't have to be... Listen, there are people from different ethnicities that don't get along with each other,
right?
It's about finding people who have the same wants, the same work ethic, the same view on corporate growth and profits. Those are the people you want working together.
That's why it's hard to find people for jobs, right? I mean, it's a big
part of it,
because you're not just looking at a resume. You're trying to fit a piece into a puzzle where that piece has never seen the puzzle.
If I told you how many people come in and say, oh, I want to work in this culture, and we go, great, why? Well, I've read about it and seen it. Those people work 60 hours a week. Well, I wouldn't have to. Well, you don't really like the culture that much.
Tom Gimble from LaSalle Network. You can find more, follow him on Twitter, at LaSalle Network.
At LaSalle Network and at Tom Gimble.
All right, buddy. Nice to see you.
Always good to
see
you.
Have a great break. We'll talk again soon.
Likewise.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
He's making a list, he's checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty and nice.
It's 12:37. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. Maybe you're making your list. You're running around to the mall or the store or online for last-minute gift buying. That's why Maria LaManna is here. She writes for MarketWatch, and she's going to talk to us about credit card debt. You talk about a buzzkill, Maria.
I know. It is a buzzkill this time of year when we're all shopping.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. I love talking to you. And, you know, I was just looking at some, Maria writes for MarketWatch, so I just kind of looked at what she's written recently, and it looks like you only write 4 or 5 stories a day.
It looks like probably more than it actually is, but thank you. I'll pass that along to my editor.
Sure. Let's start with the credit card debt, because the lead of your story is that Americans may soon may exceed the amount of credit card debt that they racked up during the Great Recession. So have we learned no lessons? I mean, where are we when it comes to credit card debt?
Right. So we actually have learned some lessons. Americans have gotten a little bit more of a grip on credit card debt than we did at the peak of the recession. The average household credit card debt is down a little bit from the peak of the recession in 2008 and 2009, but it's coming back up again. So this analysis that I looked at says that by the end of 2019, we'll be back to pre-recession levels of credit card debt.
Okay.
So, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know more about this than I do, but you know, there's a consumer sentiment gauge, I think, came out today that was pretty positive, or recently anyway. I mean, credit card debt isn't a good thing, but if it's going up, does that at least show some hope and some belief in the economy? And I mean, can there be a positive view that way?
Right, definitely. I think that is part of it. You know, as long as we are paying our bills back in full and not racking up tons of interest, it's actually not a terrible thing. But, you know, unfortunately, so many people are paying a lot of interest on their debt, which is the reason it's a negative. You know, people with subprime scores are actually getting credit cards in lower numbers than before. Millennials actually are shying away from credit cards. So it seems like our behavior is actually getting better in some ways. And we are putting an emphasis on saving versus spending in some ways. But again, you know, when you look at the number, which is more than $16,000 in
money.
Debt per household, that's a lot of money.
$16,000 in credit card. That doesn't include mortgage or car payments or student loans, anything like that. That's just what you're carrying on your credit card.
Correct, which is a huge amount of money. So,
that's
yeah.
a lot. Okay. And I know that there was you did a graph sort of about what states have a harder time paying it back than others. And it looks like Illinois is just kind of in the middle when it comes to that.
Yes. Yeah, so for that analysis, we looked at median income in the state versus the average amount of credit card debt in the state. And it came out that Alaska actually has the hardest time paying back, although they have high incomes versus some other states in the nation. They also have very high levels of credit card debt. So, again, you know, could be a good thing if people are paying it back in full and they're just taking advantage of rewards and using their credit card responsibly. But there are many cases in which that's not happening.
And you write some of this from a NerdWallet study. So let me read just a little bit. And this explains it some. While median household income has grown 28% over the last 13 years, the cost for medical costs have gone up 57%, beverage prices 36%. So what we're seeing is it's not always just a lack of discipline. It's the fact that income has not kept up with the rising costs of the goods and services that we need and depend on.
Correct. That is a lot of what went into this study. You know, rent has risen almost 4% in the last year alone. There's a lot of mounting expenses. So I do think it's partially that people are, you know, just struggling to get by with what they need to buy. That may be their mortgage. That may be student loans. There's a lot of things that are weighing on people's wallets. And, you know, you could argue some of those things are a choice. You don't have to take on a mortgage. You don't have to take on student loans. But then what ends up happening is people end up struggling with just the daily expenses and putting that on their credit card.
Well, you don't have to buy that fifth gift for your wife or your husband or your son or your daughter if you're listening right now. They'll be happy with four, so save a little bit of cash there.
True.
And then another story of yours, and I want you to explain this one to me because I'm not sure I get it, but the headline is that this might be a good time to get a credit card that where rewards are offered. There's competition there, or explain that to me.
Yes. So 2016 was kind of a landmark year in credit card rewards. I think consumers have gotten a little bit savvier about how to use credit cards to their advantage, and a lot of banks and credit card companies are responding. A lot of headlines this year were about the Chase Sapphire Reserve card, which offers a huge sign-up bonus and a lot of perks throughout the year, including different travel perks. And so there's just started to be this sort of arms race among credit card companies to offer the most lucrative packages. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that that may not be able to keep up. You know, the Fed recently raised rates, and in turn, probably a lot of credit card companies are going to be raising their rates. And so if they're not getting a good return on those, they're not going to keep being able to offer all these crazy high rewards.
Jamie Dimon says that they lost a couple $100 million on the Sapphire card?
They did. And I think what's interesting about that specific case is that it did create so much buzz on its own, and so many people signed up for the card that, you know, Chase is kind of making a long-term play. They're getting a lot of people in the door, a lot of young consumers, a lot of high spenders that are probably going to be now Chase customers for other things, and they can cross-sell, you know, mortgages and other types of loans to those people. So in and of itself, I don't think it's fair to say that that was a bad choice on the part of Chase, but, you know, it did end up costing them in the short term.
Okay. Are these rewards helping people with $16,000 in credit card debt, or are they helping the people who can afford to pay off their credit? I mean, are these benefits for the rich, or are they for all of us?
Exactly. So there's kind of this upper tier of the sort of best credit cards with the best rewards. And in the past, that was kind of thought of as the American Express card. Like, that was the, you know, peak card to get. And I think Chase has kind of made a play at American Express trying to make their NewCard sort of a competitor for them. So there is this sort of upper tier, and I think those people also tend not to be the people paying a lot of interest. So there's just this tension there, because obviously the credit card companies have to make money on people paying interest, and then they use that to finance all these crazy rewards. So I think if you're a consumer, it actually works out in your favor, because if you can learn a little bit about how these things work and you can be responsible, you can really cash in and take a lot of advantage of it. You can take, you know, entire trips for free. You can stay in hotels on your points. You can, if you learn about it, you can really take advantage. But, you know, you don't want to be one of the people who's being taken advantage of by paying all that interest.
We're talking to Maria Lamana. She writes for MarketWatch, and just about a few of the stories that she's written. Okay, Maria, I've spent much of this holiday season talking to people about the benefits of giving, like the Dollar Shave Club or Birchbox. In fact, I'm giving some subscriptions this year for Christmas. And MarketWatch wrote a series of columns, 10 things you should not buy in 2017. And one of them, the one written by you, was about subscription services.
Yes. So this was an interesting one. You know, I think sort of what came out of why that story was written is because, you know, we are seeing all these statistics about how little Americans have saved. You know, about half of U.S. adults don't even have $400 in savings, which is pretty staggering, you know, and kind of goes along with what we're seeing with this amount of huge amount of credit card debt. So a lot of financial experts I've talked to have said, where can you cut back? You know, look at your subscriptions, look at what these recurring expenses, and see if there's anything that you can cut back on. So I think if people are signing up for subscription services, and there are people who need something to get rid of, that's kind of an easy thing to look to.
So the idea is, it's not that they're not good or reputable. It's just that that's a monthly drain out of your wallet that you might not necessarily need.
Right. And Dollar Shave Club actually is a good example of a company that is filling a need that people buy recurring on a recurring basis. You know, you may get a razor every month, or and they're actually very affordable razors from Dollar Shave Club. But a lot of the other subscriptions are kind of a nice to have, or,
right,
you know, people describe them as opening a gift every month for yourself, that it's sort of filled with unexpected things and you don't know what's going to be inside.
Like butters around the world. Right. I get butters around the world.
Right, exactly. And yeah, and if you get it as a gift, that's great, and you don't have to worry about cutting that out of your budget. But, you know, I think in many cases, we could probably agree it's something that people don't actually need. It's just sort of, you know, you don't feel the pain of it. It comes out of your credit card every month, and you're not actually making the payment. And then all of a sudden, you're like, where did that, you know, $100 go over the course of the year?
Maria Lamana, great to talk to you again. Have a great Christmas and a happy new year, okay?
Thanks, you too. Good to talk to you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, 12:53 on a Friday afternoon. And right over my right shoulder, across the Chicago River, is this monster star that is being assembled, just as it was last year for the Chi-Town Rising Festival. John Murray is one of the supporters and organizers of that, and he's in the studio. John, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks. Great to be here.
All right, so this is a business show. I saw, come on, you guys were claiming like $20 million in economic benefit last year.
Choose Chicago.
Yeah.
The Convention and Tourism Bureau estimated $20 million in economic impact and $2 million in direct tax revenue generated from the event last year.
So, okay, we get the taxes. Where does that $20 million come from?
Well, so the way those economic impact models work is they factor in the jobs created through the economy. So we have a lot of people
working.
Construction work going on. There's a lot of people that come into town. So we have already 15,000 people have downloaded tickets from 25
Great.
Countries and 45 states. So people are coming into the city, staying in the hotels, staying in the restaurants.
I'm a real booster. I love this. I wasn't down here for it, but I was watching it on TV. And, you know, I was just telling you off the air, Chicagoans, like, sometimes they're a little too cool for the room, you know, and they're like, oh, they don't want to embrace something new, or they want to ridicule something new rather than embrace it. I know, you know, that's something you have to deal with.
Absolutely. And look, I'm a hometown boy. I grew up on the west side of the city. So I have a little bit of that in me as well.
Right.
But I also know the benefit of creating something. And one of the reasons why we created that star you see across the river as such a large icon, the largest New Year's Eve icon of any city in the world, was to have those sort of those bragging rights,
right,
and to point to something that says, look, this is something we can be proud of as a city. It's very aspirational. It's big. It's impressive. And it makes a real statement.
Maybe I've gotten a little ahead of myself, but we're talking about Chi-Town Rising, which is the New Year's Eve celebration in town. It's the second year for it. And it's a dual thing, right? I mean, it's a party here in Chicago, but it's a TV show for all of our lifetimes, we would watch a replay of the Times Square crystal ball dropping. Now people in the Midwest have a live sort of celebration to watch.
That's absolutely right. We didn't want to compete with New York or London or Sydney or any place else. We wanted to have, like those cities do, a celebration that fits our time zone. And
right.
what we believed and what we saw last year with 1.7 million people tuning in from across the Midwest was that people are hungry for something that is live and world-class in terms of entertainment value to watch on New Year's Eve after the ball drops in New York.
All right. I'm assuming you want everyone to watch it, but you would even prefer more to come downtown to see it, right? How do they do that?
We want to see both. And, yeah, we've tripled the free viewing space this year. We'll have secure viewing areas both on the north and south sides of the river. The south side of the river, guaranteed free tickets, just sold out. So it's space available now only on the south side. There's still guaranteed free tickets available on the north side, but they're going fast. And then there's also, you know, pay party options for people that want to have access to a VIP experience or with one of our restaurant partners like Howls and Hood right here next door to you,
right.
Or the Corona Beach House party that's going to be at incredible experience over inside the Hyatt, transforming a ballroom into an incredible beach club.
So if you were to grade last year's ordeal, all of it, what grade would you give it?
I'll give us a solid B+.
All right. How do you get up to an A this year?
So we listened to what people wanted. They wanted more free viewing areas. They wanted more of a Chicago-centric cast.
Okay. I remember that. So, I get that. That's fair.
So we really added that. You know, everyone from Jim Cornelison singing the national anthem and acting as our countdown stage host to Sir the Baptist, you know, Bronzeville Zone,
right.
Performing. And the hosts on NBC and Telemundo are also have a local flavor this year. So that makes a big difference.
And David Miranda, who's in the next room there and works in the newsroom, will be on doing a little TV, right, on New Year's Eve. So. Yeah.
Absolutely. Good to see you.
Telemundo.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, listen, I wish you great success. I hope that it's twice as successful this year as it was last year, because I'd love to see local things grow and prosper.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your support.
Thanks for coming in.
Take care.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. So if you are interested in tickets or more information for Chi-Town Rising, to check out their website, chitownrising.com. All right, that's going to wrap it up for the Business Lunch. Real quick, thank you very much for listening through this past year to the Biz Lunch. I certainly enjoy it. I enjoy bringing it to you, and it's just a pleasure. I'm going to be off for a few days next week, but can't wait to hit it hard in 2017. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.